Thank you. Thank you, Isaac. Welcome to the forum on gender and Cornell protest in the 1960s. I'm Kathleen Long, the Director of Feminist Gender and Sexuality Studies. My colleague Sabine Henney, Director of American Studies, and I will be moderating this forum. We would like to thank Isaac Kramnick for organizing this event, which has been wonderful. Gretchen Ritter. We would also like to thank Gretchen Ritter, our dean, and her office for supporting it, as well as the Government Department and the Africana Studies Program. And we would like to thank Cecilia Chapa for all of the hard work she has done. All right, so along with the two major social movements previously addressed in these events, the anti-war and civil rights movements, there was a third that arose in the context of protests around the country and that took hold in Cornell in 1969, feminism. Sheila Tobias organized the four-day conference on women that took place in January of that year, as well as the first women's studies course at Cornell offered in 1970. Irene Smalls founded Worry House, the black women's residence on this campus, which is still here, and later the Black Alumni Association. While our speakers may have been leaders for the SDS, like David Burak, or foot soldiers, as Lisa Johnson describes herself, their commitment to social justice at Cornell and throughout their careers has always crossed boundaries, linking issues of race, gender, and socioeconomic status. They were practicing intersectionality long before there was a term for it, and we are still catching up to them. They have all remained lifelong activists. Lisa Johnson as medical director of community-based clinics for the San Francisco Department of Public Health. Susan Reverby as the first professor of women's studies at Wellesley. My husband told me that. And a medical historian intent on revealing and ending unethical practices, such as the experiments at Tuskegee and in Guatemala City. Irene Smalls as an award-winning author and education activist. David Burak as a peacemaker, fostering exchanges between the United States and Vietnam, and protesting our current wars. Sheila Tobias is a leading researcher on gender and education. I have to say their activist spirit continues at Cornell. A couple years ago, FGSS students had a sit-in in front of Day Hall after a series of sexual assaults on campus in order to push the administration to work harder to protect all students on campus. It did have some effect, the struggle continues. And I'm hoping that their activist spirit continues to inspire Cornell students. The fact that American Studies and FGSS are collaborating on this event speaks to how American Studies has changed over the years. That FGSS now includes lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender studies shows that we continue to grow and evolve. And now to the speakers.
So I'm just going to be the bad guy trying to keep time, and I'm just going to introduce people by name again as they come up here and speak. I'm supposed to keep people to 10 minutes, and then there should be plenty of time for conversation. We will start with Irene Smalls, who will have to leave afterwards. Called. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's a great pleasure to be here, to come back to Cornell after many years. And I guess that I feel like I'm a traitor on this panel, that the idea of having a panel talking about feminist studies and women's studies and so on and so forth, because during the civil rights movement and particularly the black student movement at Cornell, that women were told that we had to be not subservient, but we couldn't assume leadership roles. And the understanding was that after founding Worry House and, you know, leading protests and, you know, a range of things that we did to get the administration to finally pay attention to us and picking the house and picking the words and, you know, all the other kind of stuff, they told me I couldn't run for president of the Afro-American Society. And I said, why? And they said, because you're a girl. And I said, well, what does that have to do with it? And what they responded was that, well, you know, black women can be very strong, and we want to build up our families and our culture, and we want our men to take leadership roles. And at that point, I was 19 years old, and I said, okay. And so I took a back seat. And I did whatever I could in terms of supporting and no longer considering even running for president of the Afro-American Society, because I felt that, okay, we need to support our black men, and there was a whole thing about the struggle, and who was the famous black activist who said black women have a role and it's to be prone? Oh, there you go. And so, again, you know, I was being faithful to the struggle because I was willing to do whatever it was to move the community forward, to move the civil rights movement forward on Cornell's campus. And, you know, did things behind the scenes, did things that were in support of other kinds of things, but no longer assumed that I could be a leader because I was a girl, and that's all there was to it. And in terms of leaving Cornell after I graduated in 1971, one of the concerns I had was the sustainability of some of the progress that I felt we had made. And that was why I said we need a Cornell Black Alumni Association. And the idea was that you'd have this group of hotbed, intelligent, highly intelligent activists, and they were leaving. And that it was too easy to have old patterns and old cultural kinds of institutional things take hold again, and we would lose the gains that we had made. And so the Cornell Black Alumni Association, there were three women and one guy we had at our first meeting, and I was the first president because nobody said I couldn't. There you go. And then actually I wasn't present very long because I moved. We started in New York City and I moved to Boston. So I gave up the presidency. But the whole concept of gender has a different resonance in the African American community than it does in the, you know, wider American community. And I guess that one of the things that Angela Davis said, which I never ever forgot, was she said that black women are the essence of all that white women are trying to be. That we are independent. We are self-defining. And she went on, I don't remember the exact quote, and I think that that's true. And very often when I see women's studies, it's always white women's studies. It does not include the experience of women of color in this country. And that's sort of an indictment, I really feel, that it shouldn't be women's studies, it should be white women's studies, and then maybe there's somebody else around. So I think in all fairness that we have to include the whole feminine experience in this country, and that women were beasts of burden, that we were, you know, the bearers of children, and, you know, so on and so forth, and looking at the different cultural contexts, the different socioeconomic levels that, you know, women are situated in this society, and how that impacts their femininity. That there was a article I read about Venus and Serena Williams, who are, you know, just extraordinary athletes and so on and so forth, and they were referred to as brutish, beastly, and they were women. And I hadn't heard any of the white tennis players referred to as brutish or beastly. And so what we have to be very, very careful about is that the racism that white men have, white women have too. And let's be real about that. That one of the major issues that a lot of black women have had with the feminist movement is that some of those women are really racist. They have black maids that they treat like dirt, and yet they want to be free. You know, they're free because they have black women feeding their babies, cleaning their houses, etc. So I think that in terms of looking at a real feminist ideology and a real feminist approach, we have to address the issues of race, we have to address the issues of class, and we have to address the issues of sexism. But I think that too often, white feminists don't even want to think about it. They don't want to talk about it. And so from my point of view, as a black student activist, my position was to support the black community, to support the goals and the objectives of the African American community on Cornell's campus, and therefore my role as a female was a secondary aspect of what I was trying to achieve and what I was working toward. And there were not, you know, in terms of the feminist movements and the feminist studies, there wasn't a lot of cross-fertilization that there weren't that many black women involved, at least that I know of. I know that Dr. Joseph, through Audre Lorde and the kind of work that, you know, poetry and literature that Audre Lorde wrote, she was very feminist and, you know, oriented, and I think it's very important. I think that the goals can be similar, but I think we have to be realistic, because my experience has been that, you know, when you look at racism, it's the larger issue, at least for women of color. And then if you look at the economic structure of this country, you have actually Asians at the top making the most in terms of wage earners. You have white men, and then you have white women, and then you have black men, and then you have, trying to remember, Hispanic, because I was just looking at the numbers about 2 weeks ago. And at this point, blacks earn more than Latinos, but that's shifting. But as I said, I don't see a lot of reaching across the aisle, reaching across the cultural or racial divide that by white women, particularly upper income, middle class white women, educated white women, to reach out and talk to. I guess that I was very impressed when Susan was talking about working with low income women, and she said she would dress like them. That, and she saw the women who were her age who had 2 and 3 kids, because they got pregnant at 16 or 17 because there weren't a lot of choices in their lives and so on and so forth. So rather than looking down at those women, and you have to understand and be culturally sensitive to the role of women, the situation of women, the circumstances that women are often thrust in, and, you know, do their best to absolutely extricate themselves and do better for their families. And the one thing that I remember the most about, there was a UN study, and what they said, if you want to uplift a community, you give the money to the women, those microloans. Because if you give the money to the men, well, you know, the bars are going to get a few, the ladies of the evening are going to get a few dollars, and maybe there'll go in some business, but if you give money to women, it's going to go into the children, it's going to go into the home, it's going to go into the family. And that's the way to greatly impact, to most greatly impact a community. And so in the case of African-American women who have always worked, and the big thing, again, because we had to. You know, the economic reality was we had to work, we had to contribute to the economic well-being of the family. And I think that that's a rich strength and a resource that we're not appreciated for or recognized for. So in terms of feminism, as I said, I do feel like a fraud. Because even though I've acted like a feminist, been a feminist all my life, I've never wanted that name. Because it had, to me, a sort of a bitter aftertaste because of the racism tinge that was always there associated with it. And I think that's something that, you know, white women need to address before they can really say that they're feminists. Thank you.
And the second speaker will be Lisa Johnson.
Thank you. Welcome, everybody. I want to, and thank you, Irene. I really appreciated the comments. And yeah. I'm going to actually take us back to the reality of myself as a 17-year-old white middle-class girl coming to Cornell's campus. And slowly becoming aware of feminism, and I think a lot of your comments are actually quite relevant to that experience. But I came here in 66, I was here from 66 to 69, and left after my junior year. Where did I come from? I came from a public high school in Manhattan, small, all girls, and unlike a lot of the friends of mine later in the movement, I did not come from a politically active family. There was no talk of politics or even the news of the day around the dinner table, and I came from a family with very traditional gender roles. My mother did not go to college and didn't work out of the outside of the house, and my father was a pathologist in an academic center, so there was quite a bit of kind of his life, his career really determined what went on in our lives. When I came here, I was planning to be an English major because I like to read fiction. And if you had pushed me, which nobody did, if you'd pushed me to imagine my future. It was going to be finish Cornell, have fun there, you know, get good grades, but enjoy yourself, go back to New York, get an interesting job, which was probably in publishing maybe for a few years, and then get married and have kids. And my life would probably would be determined by the career of my hopefully sort of professional or, you know, husband who had some kind of interesting job. And this is embarrassing to admit now, but was not at all uncommon among middle-class educated girls who were coming from a similar background. So why did I join SDS the first month I was here? You wouldn't think so. But there were other forces at play, a lot of them historical. One was I was quite aware of the Vietnam War, and I was horrified by what I was seeing and reading, and I basically concluded it was illegal, it was immoral. And it was wasteful because I had kind of bought the idea of the Great Society, these social programs that were going to address things that were also really horrifying, the poverty and the kinds of racism, the things that I was quite aware of. And you could make common sense that you really actually can't have guns and butter, and you could see the direction this was going. So I was quite anti-war by the time I got here. But, and I was looking for an expression of it. But on a more personal level, my brother had just, he's older than me, had just left college, and he admits it now, was clueless. He just walked right into the ramp up of troops that were going to Vietnam, and he and my family and their, you know, their inarticulate way, everybody was tense and struggling with what the options were. And so I was feeling guilty that I didn't have these same choices to make. I was feeling very bad that this was happening to my friends, my boyfriend, my brother, and I wanted to be involved in that. So that's what it was like when I first got to Cornell. I did not, and I was involved in SDS throughout the 3 years here, and not only in draft resistance support, anti-war work, but also widening out to support of the black students' issues and demands and divestment from the South African apartheid regime that Cornell was invested in. And that was very important to me. It was my political education because my actual formal education was in literature, and I loved it, but it was kind of a little side bubble. I was kind of educated on two tracks, one in the classroom and one outside. I did not develop a feminist perspective at Cornell, and I am embarrassed to say I did not go to the 1969 women's meeting that Sheila's going to talk about, but there were some things at Cornell at that time that really bugged me and that I never forgot. One was just the in loco parentis, that girls had curfews, boys did not. They had this thing where you had to show up and eat in the dining halls on little flowered plates at the time they wanted, wearing a skirt that felt kind of like we were being trained to be gracious hostesses for our husbands in the future. It was ridiculous. And on a much sort of substantive level, and something that echoed, sort of resonated for me in the future, if you wanted to get do anything about birth control and be responsible about birth control, you had to go off campus. There was a clinic here that was known as 50 Fingers. It was five gynecologists. Some of you may be nodding. And this is where you would go for birth control pills, and you did not get any kind of reasonable sex education or education about the potential. Let's all just admit it. We got right. So that really stuck with me. I mean, that was, you know, and there wasn't a lot of options. It was birth control pills, which were very high dose in those days, or nothing. That's what you went there for. So, and then the other thing about Cornell that was sort of startling to me was the gender differentiation of what you were supposed to be doing in life was so clear in the colleges. So you had home ec. You actually had the home ec department, and then you had, you know, engineering. Actually, ILR was very heavily male, ag, and it was just really sorted by gender almost in a very noticeable way. So that's one of the things that I remember from there. SDS, my involvement was very very male-dominated, the SDS meetings. Yes, I noticed it, and no, most of the voices were male, the leadership were men. I did not challenge that. I think my own self-conception at the time was one of being a person who provided support, both sort of emotional and moral support, but also logistical support. So I did a lot of mimeoing and handing out of leaflets, this kind of thing. And I think when I look back, again, I think my basic self-conception was to be in that, in a support role. And it took me years, some years of growing up, and it took the women's movement to help me think of myself, as I now think of myself, as having agency and having sort of a proactive approach to making my life be what I want it to be. And that did not happen at Cornell, although I imagine the seeds were laid. I left in 1969 with my good friend Susan over here. We dropped out of college from a sense of frustration that the war wasn't over. Why wasn't it over after our 3 years of hard work? And I personally had, I know we were young and impatient, I personally actually felt that I had come to kind of a dead end. My strategy of being both politically active and learning about that and also being a engaged English literature major had kind of run aground. I did not want to pursue an academic career in English literature, and so it didn't make sense to hang around for another year to write a thesis. So I gave my father a break on the tuition and headed off to learn more about the world. And what, I did, actually. It was great. It was a wonderful exposure to kind of the international peace movement, to youth culture across Europe, and very much widened my perspective. When I came back, my question in my mind was, okay, what are the social institutions in America that are failing people and in that way contributing to the social injustice that I'm seeing around me? And which of these institutions might I be able to do something in? Because if I could answer that question, that would answer the question of what skills I needed, which would be a reason why I would go back to school and get trained in something. But I didn't have an answer to that question at that point. So I went out to Seattle and joined up with some of my Cornell friends. We continued some activism there, some demonstrations and anti-war work. But a couple things happened to me there. I was exposed to the free clinic movement that was just starting. Which the slogan from that, which has always been very dear to my heart, is healthcare is a right, not a privilege. And that's been sort of the basis of my work life ever since. But it came from the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic, actually. And the women's movement, which was really rising up and sweeping the nation and had its own expression in Seattle. So the first women's movement, group that I joined was not just a consciousness-raising group, which was a common experience for white women moving into the women's movement. It was actually a consciousness-raising group that was also a work group to set up the first women's clinic in Seattle, which was, in the beginning once a week, and eventually we had a full-service, full-week, really solid clinic to deliver comprehensive, respectful, non-patriarchal, initially gynecology, reproductive health care, and then we widened out to primary care. I really loved it. I loved the way we worked together, which was so different than some of the meetings I'd sat through in all those years in politics. It was very concrete. I loved the women. They were just an amazing community of women and very energized. And I actually was startled by how much I liked the clinical content. And click, suddenly I wanted to do something very specific, get a skill that would allow me to then open up worlds of being able to take my values and bring them into a context where I could improve things. And because I'm down to 1 minute, I think, I'm going to just fast forward and say that's what I did. And that's actually amazing. I just retired about it's 6 months ago now. And I look back at the work that I did in community clinics as a physician working primarily with multi-ethnic people who are low income but also have a lot of barriers to care that come from different cultures, maybe recent immigrants, different languages, different understandings of healthcare. I've always really loved that kind of extra work of the rewards of cross-cultural medicine and extending and opening up primary care homes to people who otherwise would really be marginalized from a medical sense. So that's what I have done, and I am very grateful to my experience at Cornell, actually, that in a way sort of set me on that path. I think of myself as a kind of a poster child for second wave feminism. I moved into what had been traditionally a male profession, and it was very successful for me, but I have no illusions that there's not a lot of work to be done. I am in the women's side of medicine. There's a lot of gender, gender sorting. Yeah, tremendous, between surgeons, which is why I'm so amazed by Mary Jo. Surgeon to primary care. I'm supposed to be in primary care. I wanted to be politically, but it's also kind of where the women are supposed to be. There is a gender pay gap in medicine that startled me, actually, when I read the statistics. And Beyond that, I mean, I live in San Francisco. Just even in Silicon Valley, you look at what's going on in this new profession of the tech world, and then beyond that, to a lot of things that are things we would have hoped would not be happening at this point. So there's still lots of work to be done, but that's my story, and I want to thank Cornell actually for the part that it played. Thank you.
I guess I should have said at the beginning that there'll be plenty of time for questions and discussion after that. But now I want to welcome the sandwiched man on the panel, David Burak. Please help me welcome him.
I've always felt something in common with the Earl of Sandwich.
I'm really quite honored to be involved in this panel. I was talking with Professor Long at the reception about some of the things I think I can say that would be logical and useful about my experience with feminism, both in the early days of my politicization in SES and other groups, and my teaching and work in LA, because there's a dovetail of some potential note. When I was a senior, going into graduate school, I was approached in the cafeteria by a woman who was unknown to me at the time, but was very kind of both assertive and polite, saying, "I'm trying to do an article for a national news outlet about Cornell students and the politicization that's taking place, so I would appreciate if you would make some comments. I'm told you're involved in SES and have been speaking on campus at dorms about the war in Vietnam, et cetera." I said, "That's true." So she said, "Well, you want to say a few things about that?" I said, "Sure." So I did. And it was fairly cut and dry. I didn't ask her for any ID. I didn't ask her, you know, who was going to get this, because she didn't look like an FBI agent, and I figured it was right. True that. We'll get to that chapter later, maybe. But the next day, she came by the table again in the Ivy Room, and she looked a bit forlorn or distressed. And I said, "What's up? You don't look so perky." And she said, "Well, I want to talk to the black students about their involvement in activism and such, and their reactions to the civil rights movement, but none of them will talk to me." I said, "Really? Why is that?" She said, "I have no idea. You know, I just asked a few a little while ago, and they kind of shunned me." So I said, "Well, you know, my experience is they're pretty reasonable people. I mean, some of them are my good friends, so let's give it another try here. I mean, it's probably because they don't know who you are." And I went over and I talked to Reuben Monday and Bob Jackson, two of the leaders of the Afro-American Society at the time, and said, "You know, I talked to her yesterday, and I think I can vouch for her as a pretty decent person. You guys could probably give her a few minutes if you be so kind." I said, "All right, we will." I mean, it was just a barrier of not talking to strangers, I think, that had precluded them from a positive response initially. So they did a discussion. She came back by and said, "Thanks, I really appreciate that. It helped get this article rounded out." And 2 months later, the article appeared. I didn't realize she was writing for Esquire, but there it was, up from silence. And the author was Susan Brown Miller, who later became one of the foremost feminist theorists on issues of rape, violence, and sexual feminine identity. So, you know, she thanked me in the article, which was, even my parents had read it and thought, you know, called me and said, "Good work, you know." That was one of my first exposures to a feminist leader of national repute, or eventually of national repute. And I made a motion at an SES meeting once about a woman named Diane Weinberg, who had leadership qualities, and I nominated her for a co-chairman position at one meeting in a transition period. We were going into the summer, I think, and you know, she didn't even know I was going to nominate her, and she gave me a look like, what are you doing? You know, I said, is it all right with you? She said, yeah, all right, but you should have asked beforehand. I said, well, I figured you'd tell me if you didn't want to. And she said, well, I do want to. So she got the position, so she became one of the first elected leaders. Ellie Dorsey, who some of you remember, also became an elected leader, co-chair. And it's not like we did extraordinary things that summer, but we did have a leadership core that included progressive women who had relatively strong opinions. I mean, it's not like they yelled at us, but they argued with us and debated. And at the SDS convention in Chicago that year, I think I either gave a speech seconding the motion or even putting the motion forward to have a committee on women's issues. And the SDS was already in a stage of early fragmentation over issues relating to modes of approach to both national and international questions. You know, there was a revolutionary youth movement too, trying to focus on the working class, and there was the Progressive Labor Party prided itself on being somewhat Maoist and even more working class than the others. And there were the seeds of the Weathermen. So at that time, I gave a speech, and a group of about 20 people in the front row started hissing. And I was, you know, like taken by surprise. Who could oppose making a committee on women's issues? And it was the Progressive Labor faction from Harvard's SDS. Figures. They were progressive labor people, and they felt we have to emphasize the working class issues, the female liberation issues come later. And I thought that was crazy. I mean, all the issues got to be addressed simultaneously. But these were smart people too. I mean, they got into Harvard for reasons unbeknownst to me, but yeah, that may be true. I mean, the guy, their leader, Jared Israel, you know, he carried a red book. I thought that was pretty amazing. But in any case, that was one of my earlier efforts on the national level. And I got thanked by a lot of feminists in SDS or progressive women after for, I mean, my response was, sounds like there's a lot of leaky tires in the front three rows. Is there a problem here? You know, and they actually eventually shut up, but okay. So on another, how much time do I have? Like 3 minutes, okay. As you know, some of you know, some of the leaders in the cultural realm that I was involved with, bringing the Cornell, like Audre Lorde, who later wrote a brilliant reflection in the cancer journals on her struggled to stay alive with cancer. She was a black feminist lesbian poet of some significance in the literary realm and in the political realm. And others along that line, well, eventually, let me jump to the future. I had a class of female cadets, pre-cadets, for the LAPD. How I got to teach this class, I only have 2 minutes left now, so I can't tell you the whole backstory. But they told me that a lot of their fellow candidates who make it into the police academy are busted out because they fail the shooting test. And the reason they fail the shooting test is that the handle is designed for men. It's bigger than they can grip and shoot comfortably. And it sounded so appalling as an inequity, I wrote to Janet Reno, whom I had met in front of Teagle Hall at the last reunion and had a little pleasant exchange with, and said, this shouldn't be. Would you please have somebody look into this? And I got a letter back from her assistant attorney general, a guy named Lamb, who my class correspondent, Dick Hoffman, knows personally, it turns out. But he said, if any of them would like to make a formal complaint, I will handle it directly. And please, you know, tell them we will address the issue. Unfortunately, none of the young ladies who knew, who shared these stories wanted to stick their necks out. It's a risky thing. If you want to become a police officer, you start complaining right away to the Department of Justice. So it didn't come to pass. But it showed that even at the top levels, when a Cornell woman gets to the top of the heap, she'll respond in a positive and proactive way if you phrase the letter correctly. So that's it for me. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much. And the next speaker will be Sheila Tobias. Please help me welcome her.
Well, first, it's great to be back, to coin a phrase, and it's wonderful to have the opportunity to reflect on what all of that meant in my life. I'm going to talk a little bit about myself. When I came to Cornell, I was essentially a failed academic. I ought to have done well in graduate school. I started out with a Harvard degree, if you'll pardon the expression, and 4 years in Europe, which seasoned me, and then I returned to graduate school to study German history and politics. But something didn't catch fire in me. Only later did I understand that I am not set up to be the kind of researcher that's valued in the university, namely someone who wants to have the last word on a subject. What I really need to have is the first word on the subject. And so I'm grateful to Cornell for giving me the opportunity to launch something that was brand new. And I just wanted not to talk so much about that conference, because if you want to know more, the archives are filled with all the details, every one of the speakers, everything the speaker said. I decided then, even, that it was historic, and I paid probably out of my own pocket to have the entire conference audio taped. You know what audio tapes were like then, you know, you had to change the tapes. And then I hired a student who later went on and became a long-term friend to type up the audio tape. I wish I'd hired a male to do that, but I wasn't so far-sighted. But what I wanted to talk about in terms of myself was how important it is in the search for work, which is what so many of us get so much of our pleasure from, to believe really deeply in the significance of what you're doing. And what I failed, the reason I failed at the first bout of scholarship was that I was not impelled to have the last word on the subject. As I told my professor when I left Columbia Graduate School, I really wanted to have the first word on a subject. Well, how do you have the first word on the subject? Years later, when I had begun to study the issue of women in science, why, given the brains which have been equally distributed, we did not have the numbers or the fame or the number of Nobel laureates from the female sex that we have from the male sex, I was instructed by a professor then at Wesleyan, who was a historian of science, who said, have you ever thought about the variable, that's how scientists talk, called newness to the field? In the physical sciences in particular, there's a persistent view that youth is the condition for originality, particularly in the physical sciences. I think in the humanities, we expect maturity to bring with it more depth. But youth is attributed to youth is attributed the quality of originality. And much of the complaint about wasting investment in women in science was based on the fact that they would not, in their earliest years, in their 20s and early 30s, when productivity is expected from a scientist, be fully focused on the work they were supposed to do. This gentleman gave me cause to think that maybe the issue isn't youth, per se, but a variable which we decided together to name newness to the field. And maybe it would pay off to invest in women in science who were coming back at age 40, or even later, not dismiss them as unlikely to be productive just because they were 40 or 35, but rather to anticipate that being new to the field would enable them to be very original. That insight, that gift from that person, who also pointed out to me that a lot of very good musicians and scientists and people of talent died young. So we really can't say they did their best work when they were young because we don't have the information as to what they might have done if they hadn't died young. But in our centuries, we don't die so young. Why that's relevant to our reunion here is that my entire post-Cornell career has been characterized, if I can say so modestly, by a lot of originality. I have not just written books that weren't written before. I've written books on subjects that people didn't even think were subjects before. I have invented a means of analysis, experimental models that nobody ever thought before to do. And the reason is not anything I was gifted with, I don't think, as a young person, but simply being impelled, one, by the urgency of getting to the bottom of some of these issues, why women are not equally represented in science specifically or mathematics in particular, but also the fact that I came at these subjects as a newcomer to the field, not in any way burdened by other people's paradigms or other people's presumptions. And so if there are any students in this audience who are still searching for how to spend your intellectual capital, I really want to encourage you to be brave in addition to whatever else you are, and to be motivated. I mean, nothing has been more motivating for me personally than feminism. The possibility that in my own lifetime, I could make things change for women, simply by what I thought and what I wrote and what I chose to study. And I have not stopped. There is no end to the topics that suggest themselves to me because I am so dedicated to getting out truths about women's competency, which were buried, really, until very recently. So that conference on women, which launched Women's Studies and made a great deal of difference in many of your lives, and perhaps you'll talk about it when we have questions and answers, most of all made a difference in my life. I ceased to be a failed academic. I'm not really an academic, but that's because I choose not to be an academic. I have, I believe, made an enormous contribution to the way we think about women and the way women think about themselves. So thank you, Cornell.
So now I'm so glad we didn't give you the last word. Thank you so much. And the last speaker is Susan Reverby. Please welcome her.
Hi. In her book called The Grounding of American Feminism, Cornell alumna, actually, Nancy Fallick-Cott, who was in my class, wrote a line that I've used a million times that I loved, in which she said that the problem for feminism in general was to make gender matter and not matter at the same moment in time. And I think that that really sums up for me a lot of the issues that happened to me as a woman at Cornell. So unlike several of the people on the panel, except for David, who was in my class, I was one of the 15 women, and he was one of the 85 or 90 men that were in the ILR school. When I got here, and as Lisa said, clearly the ratio was 3.5 men to every woman at Cornell when we were here because we were stuck in the dorms and the men were allowed to live off campus or in their frats. So being a woman here was totally noticeable and totally important, and we had no vocabulary to really explain it at all. So one of my favorite stories is I'm sitting in the first introduction to ILR course, and the professor was an incredible sexist and kept using all this language. And at one point he said, in this grievance procedure, the workers thought their advisor or their supervisor thought that they were good fellas. So I raised my hand. I said, excuse me, Professor Messick, were the workers fella fellas or girl fellas? So for the rest of the time, I was in the ILR school, I was referred to as Fella by my classmates, but I knew somewhere that this was important, but I had no way to understand it. I was going to write my first paper on women in the labor movement. I wrote to Esther Peterson, then the head of the Women's Bureau, to get information, and I decided there really wasn't enough out there to write a paper, and I wrote on something called the Scanlon Plan, which was some kind of profit-sharing plan that lasted a nanosecond. So I think what happened here was that we were so conscious of being women and yet had no vocabulary, no way to explain it, and no way to really think about it, except to be pissy and angry some of the time about what was happening to us and to take it in some ways personally, but to think of it as the way it was. So when I became involved in SDS, I was gone my junior year, I came back, I came here. I remember doing all the support work. You notice I type all the time. I was probably secretary of every organization I've ever been part of till the women's movement, but I don't remember feeling particularly oppressed by the SDS men at all, actually. And here's why I think I didn't. I thought what a lot of they did was really stupid, to tell you the truth. And I thought that what women did really mattered. So I thought what the men did was all this theorizing and blah, 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 and we were the ones doing the mimeographing, making sure everybody got fed, making sure the men didn't freak out, standing in the street and organizing them into draft card burning. And so I don't remember feeling oppressed about it. What was oppressive, and I want to be really honest about it, was that our political identity as the most radical person depended on, frankly, who you were sleeping with. So part of the problem was for the men who, if the man you were with burned his card, well, that made you just the companion of this great guy. But if you didn't, then who were you politically? And I think it caused enormous tension and inability for us to have a kind of political, a real political voice. And it was, part of what happened. So I remember standing in the street, this is my favorite story about being at Cornell, other than Messex, is I'm standing in the street and Professor Rossiter, late of the government department, looked at me organizing draft card burning, and he said to me, "What are you, some Spartan woman who wants to see her man brought home on a shield?" And then he looked at me and said, "And furthermore, you're ruining my university." And I remember looking at him and saying, "Excuse me, Professor Rossiter, whose university do you think this is?" So I think, thank you. So I think I left here both sort of not trying to figure out what it meant to be a woman in that sense, but having no ways to understand it. And I got very lucky. My first job after Cornell was during the community control struggle in New York City. I worked with Black Puerto Rican and Chinese American women. I thought they were amazing and fabulous and really incredible organizers. And my feminism, and I'm sorry Irene isn't here to talk about this, was always informed by race and class, and that's certainly, and then later by sexuality issues, but was certainly part and parcel of those of us who came out of the civil rights movement, which I'd also done, and out of the left in particular. So some of her criticism of women's studies is correct, but not for all of it. I think that's really important. So my own work went on into women's health issues and then into really understanding that feminism wasn't just about a way to get women into the left, which is actually what I thought it was at the beginning, but really about me and my life and what I could do. And I got to do, my first book was actually an edited book called America's Working Women, a Documentary History, so I got to do the paper I had never done at Cornell, and I got to experience in the women's health movement and then as a historian of women's health and of nursing, and then later writing on medical research, to think about the ways gender mattered and not mattered, and to see all of that intersectionality between them. So when I got hired at Wellesley, as we said, as the first women's studies person, I got hired because the three other people before me said gender, and I said gender, race, class, sexual preference, marital status, age, disability, and they said, "Fine, you're hired." So I'm going to stop early because I really want to hear what you have to say. I want to say what Cornell taught me was not to be afraid, but also not to be foolish. And I am eternally grateful for that, but I have to say I really hated being here, and it's taken a really long time to come to terms with that. Thank you.
So I think think we're just going to open it up to questions, comments.
Jewish dyke, you know, you're on Cornell shit list. But I grew up here, and my father carried me around in his arms. You know, I know this campus better than any of you. Thank you. And I hate the place.
And then, yes.
I asked a male leader of Cornell SDS from 1965 to 69. I don't have that many regrets about what we did for draft resistance, being against the war, fighting apartheid. Fighting for housing for poor people in Ithaca, supporting African American students, you know, in their struggle. But my great regret, and I've written about this, is the sexism within our organization, which is undeniable. We had many capable, strong women in the movement, and although some were elected to the leadership of SDS, and we had some articles in our publications about sexism, our understanding was shallow. Our understanding didn't cut very deep. And, you know, for an organization that should have been for human liberation, if it was, we excluded half the world in our family at that time. I think a lot of things changed in the movement. Once the general movement, co-educational movement, after the feminist movement emerged in the late 60s, by the 70s, at least the organizations that I was in California, were much less sexist, had much more female leadership, and much more greater understanding of that. Nothing can change you more than falling in love with a feminist woman who kicks your ass all the time for fear of behavior. And nothing changed you even more than having three daughters and you see what they're going up against in a society like this. So I appreciate the fact that we can now maybe have a discussion that we never had at that time about sexism, but I'll certainly acknowledge that that was one of the great failures of the student left of the 1960s.
To express it until I was able to look through all the resources that I had available to me to find the language to explain my experiences, and I'm just so thankful for that. So it's very interesting to me to now think of this generational shift where I have so much more resources available to me because of your generation and the struggles that you went to produce that language. And I'm wondering if you could just talk more about what that experience was like in producing that language. Because for me, it's just so easy to just Google something and have so many things pop up on the internet. Or to just follow multiple blogs on social media sites where I can have people telling me this language to define my experiences.
I think the one way to think about that is that we had to talk to each other more than you do. I mean, person to person. So I think Bruce's comment about his partners and his daughters is really useful. I think we developed it more we were much more collective in that sense than I think your generation is in a particular kind of way, and we found a way to do that. I became an academic to try to think some of this through, frankly, and we tried to work together in groups to try to sort of sort this out and to figure out what words to use, how to think about things analytically. I had to essentially unlearn everything I'd been taught about the labor movement here or about women's agency. We didn't even have that language to understand it and what it meant, in Joan Scott's words, when gender becomes a useful category of analysis, what that meant. So I think what was different was we saw ourselves as a kind of part of a bigger political movement, and we were trying to save the future, but also ourselves at the same time. And it felt like our lives depended on finding that language. That's really... So if you think about when you teach, when I had to teach about Sylvia Plath or... other women poets who committed suicide, I had to really imagine what they needed to make them live. And people like, as Irene mentioned, people like Audre Lorde were really crucial to that understanding. I make sure nobody gets through my classes and doesn't know who Audre is. So I think that finding those words, finding the people to read was because our lives depended on it.
I think there was also, it was interesting, the dissemination of new ideas. We couldn't Google any of this stuff, and it was just talk. I mean, it was this explosion of talk, and the format was, you know, I mean, walk and talk. I'm still doing it with my best friends, but also with, in a conscious way, but also in, this is what the early consciousness-raising groups were about. It was, you know, women's groups for, in a variety of different things that were completely outside of academia or whatever, but it was the dissemination, very rapid dissemination of a language and ideas. Quite remarkable, actually.
It was also a process of discovery. I mean, one of the things that was the most revolutionary for me during that period was the publication of our bodies ourselves.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
I mean, we didn't know how our bodies worked.
Right.
I think that a whole generation of women owes a tremendous amount to the Boston Women's Health Collective, which produced this little encyclopedia that generated a tremendous amount of activism just by simply showing us that it didn't have to be that way. That we could be, we could imagine being treated differently by doctors. We could imagine treating each other differently. We could imagine being treated differently by our partners. And so there was a tremendous amount that we got by talking. Some of us were involved in lawsuits for equal opportunity or gender equality or something. I was, for example, in the early 70s. But it was also just a tremendous amount of discovery that was tremendously energizing. And like Lisa and Susan, I certainly did not have this vocabulary when I was at Cornell, nor did I even understand really what I was missing.
I want to make one comment, if I can, about that. I actually have written about this, but I think the problem we had is what I always refer to as the body politic problem in feminism and in women's health in particular, which is, and it's some of what you faced. There was, what we got was information. So you could give people information about their body, and in some times it was very empowering, but it also didn't really give you sometimes the roadmap to how to take on the body politic. It helped you understand what your cervix looked like or where it was, but it might not tell you how to get the clinic down the road to stop being such sexist bastards. So we struggled all the time, I think, in the health movement around the demand for services and knowledge versus how to make that political. And one of my best friends wrote the birth control chapter there, and we struggled all the time in trying to figure out how she would write the chapter on birth control that would be both about, you know, what was the most effective birth control, how to use it and get the information correct, but also make you understand why there wasn't a better mousetrap and why we didn't have it. So I think that's the struggle in the women's health movement as well that's worth saying. So I don't want to be romantic at all, frankly, about what we both did and what we also couldn't figure out how to do often.
Hi, I just wanted to say thank you to all the women on the panel to say I'm proud to be related. And I'm sorry, Irene, who wasn't able to stay. But I feel like we became each other's role models. And that was my life has been enriched by my women friends. And in fact, I can't imagine any of the things that I've done in my life, any of the murder trials or any of the resistance I've been engaged in happening at all without the support of my women friends. And that's something that I encourage young women and students to foster among yourselves. You have to counter a lot of cultural narratives about girls being mean to each other and find ways to connect and the phrase we were always saying to each other was, the same thing happened to me once, and it is going to happen to you just by virtue of being a female. You are going to have similar experiences, and you have a lot more in common with each other than you do.
Girls arming to each other.
Okay, moving on.
There's somebody in the back.
The lady in the back?
Way
in the back?
Can you go first and then we can
start?
Hi, so as those of us who are here right now, it's sometimes, and I'm thinking about these issues, it sometimes becomes confusing because almost every idea and everything you say, some would call it, you know, feminist, another would call it misogynist, and it could become difficult sometimes to differentiate or have a conversation about that when there are so many different views among well-intended people who are trying to do good, whether it be in related to feminism or even the bigger issue of sexuality and gender itself. What would you suggest is the best approach to making your point of view when you have so many people telling you so many things? Because just the example that you gave about the gun thing, I was like watching a clip, Ellen DeGeneres making fun of people who came to her asking to advertise a pen that was for women.
Yeah, right.
It was like
the big pen,
pink and blue pen. And some are like, oh, I guess it probably, you know, I don't think women need different pens, but I don't know. Maybe it's, you know, tenor pens would probably be helpful. Should we just go, oh, that's offensive, or should we try to? How do you
just
think about these things?
In the gun issue, I'm a firm believer. Being in LA, we read constantly about abusive force issues where police officers will either shoot or beat a suspect even when there's no rational reason to do so. And the stories I've heard when I taught from my pre-cadet students and from other female police officers indicate that they have often developed a different approach to policing, where they will talk first before using either a club or the threat of shooting or shooting. So this is, I mean, a 54-year-old black woman English teacher, former English teacher, who had become a little disoriented and was living out of a shopping cart, was shot to death by a white bicycle cop because she wouldn't give up the shopping cart. And the law had just changed like 2 days before, where if you're more than a block away from a supermarket, then you're charged with theft. So in any case, I think that you have to make an intellectual and philosophical examination of each issue. It's never entirely easy, but if you're watching what is going on in society and you get a strong feeling that there's a substantial injustice because of sexual imbalance in a unit crucial to maintaining law and order, then you want to integrate it. You want to integrate it both by race and sex and sexual preference, because people get beaten by people who don't understand them or don't care to understand them.
But I think you were asking a bigger question, I think, about where to put your energy and how to think about what language to use and where to talk about, if I heard you correctly. And I think one of the things that God said in one of the other meetings, now everything's mushing in my brain about when I heard it and who said this, but I really think it's about where your passion lies. I think Sheila said that here tonight, too. It is about finding the thing that moves you the most, and it will call your heart as well as your brain, and you'll know it. You know, it's sort of a little bit like falling in love. I mean, you have to kind of make a leap, and I think it will call you, and you will know what that issue is. You won't know what to do. I don't think that that's what happens, but you will know where to put your energy. And I think that that's what happens, that people go, that people do the best work when it's really the most important to them. I'm sorry, I can't hear you say that again.
Dissident feminist.
Like
Camille Pollyann, Christina Hoff Sommers, I guess.
I can't stand her, to tell you the honest truth. She once called me up. Wellesley becomes the substitute variable for Hillary Clinton. So in the 90s, she actually called me up and wanted to come to one of my classes. And I said, you can audit the whole course, but you can't show up to one arbitrary class. And then she wrote bullshit about our department. So frankly,
this was
Hoff Sommers. Yeah, in the 80s. And my other favorite story was, David Horowitz, this horrific guy who wrote about, criticized the academics. So he wrote in this piece that Wellesley's Women's Studies in the 90s had written a letter to the history department saying, women don't let your daughters grow up to be historians because we told them that it was all white men's history. But he said we wrote a letter. So I wrote him and said, so produce the letter. And of course, there wasn't one. They were totally lying. And I got him to back off. But unfortunately, the Wall Street Journal also picked it up and put it in their column. And then I got calls from 6,000 alumni about how this was terrible that we were doing this. And I had to keep explaining that, of course, we wouldn't imagine doing such a thing. So that's my feeling about those people. I frankly think they lie, if you really want to know.
In the very back.
I'm curious. Sometimes when I'm speaking with my 88-year-old grandmother, she has a lot of trouble understanding feminist issues, and she seems to think that searching for equality is saying like we all should be the same. And I'm curious whether you got a lot of pushback from older generations of women and how you dealt with that, if you did.
Let me try to answer that, because I'm probably the age of your grandmother. The issue of same or different actually divided the feminist movement in the 1980s. There was a group, they called itself Difference Feminists, because they accused those of us who were looking for equality as looking for sameness. And you can just see this sort of on a graph, if you like. Here we are trying to reshape women or allow women to reshape themselves. So in what direction do you go? In order to become human, which we would all agree we'd like women to become, and there is no model for human, the only model is masculine. And so the fear was that those of us who were looking for equality in an existing system, equal number of women on the Supreme Court, equal number of women in power positions in the workforce, were perforce having to model our women that we were trying to reshape in the form of men. And pushback came. Carol Gilligan is probably best known for writing about the possibility, and this was a theoretical argument, that you could be equal and different. And we call these, I have a chapter in my book on feminism called The Difference Feminists. And it was, in my view, then and now, a healthy argument. I mean, how do you reshape the ambitions and the self-image of a population when the only other populations are denying their sameness and are not like them? And it would be equally true for minorities, people of color, who are trying to gain equality without becoming white. So these are good discussions. They are intellectually rewarding to engage in, and I don't apologize for any of them.
Can I comment on that also? And a very specific example of this, there's a great book that I read recently, which was written by a friend of someone. I didn't know her that well, but over the years she's become a friend of mine, and she was in medical training when I was. And the book is called Five Women Doctors Look Back, When the Personal Was Political. It's a great book. And basically, it was her study group when there were just a small number of women in medical school. She was down in San Francisco when I was up in Seattle, but same years. And that study group got them, you know, sort of hauled each other through the experience and was very aware of this issue of, do I want to be that? I mean, I want to be a doctor, but I don't want to be sidelined and be like a woman doctor in a sense of that has less value. But boy, do I not want to be that. And male they struggle, particularly what, you know, whatever the, so it had to do with what kind of relationship you had with your patients. Was it more of an old style patriarchal, or were you evolving something new? It had to do with power relationships inside the work team, all kinds of stuff. And it really brought it all back reading that. And then she got them all together again about 5 years ago. Five of them who are still practicing in the Bay Area, and they just sat there and they methodically talked through like year one, year two, year et cetera, and then what it was like being on the rotations. And this issue came up over and over and over again. So, you know, it's the kind of thing that if you're interested in that question, you may not be interested in medicine, but it's the way that women were trying to kind of, you know, who am I and how do I feel good about this without taking on this the model that I walked into. Then, yeah.
Hi. So my question is about the state of our current university. So, excuse me. What steps do you think that current Cornell students can take to combat issues of discrimination as a result of sexism, racism, et cetera? Because during the 1960s, obviously there's more instances of outwardly blatant discrimination, and now it's definitely more of a covert mechanism. So how should students today be going about combating these issues?
Throw it to the academician.
Oh, God. You can't do what we did. I mean, that's the answer. It's each moment is a different historic period. I mean, this is me, the historian. But, you know, it's going to look different. And you're absolutely right, the blatancy of it. But, Bruce brought it up, I think, in one of the things that he said when we all started out doing voting rights, and now we're still doing voting rights, right? It just takes a different form. In the 19th century, you know, we looked at lynching patterns, and now we just look at cops shooting people who are unarmed. So it's a different form of lynching, or we put people in jail forever. The issues are different, but I think that what worked for us here, I guess, is the big lesson is that it had to be something that we could organize the most people around. It was something that really affected the most number of us that we could find. And so I think it has to come organically out of what you see as the issue, and then the tactics will vary. I mean, the students at Syracuse are sitting in. It doesn't mean that that's what you need to be doing, but I think there are ways in which what you pick has to be powerful enough to get more people behind you, because there's nothing that scares administrators more, frankly, than a lot of students showing up somewhere. Faculty, not so much, but the students, yes.
Could I add to that just one? There are things that you can do when your heart or soul or intellect team up and move you to do them with friends that may not seem to apply to the same set of issues that we were motivated by perhaps in the 60s and 70s. But there's interconnectivity that's yet to be determined with specificity. For example, I have an acquaintance who was at My Lai, who was an American soldier there. When I went to Vietnam to teach back in 97, I read a Vietnamese publication that talked about various places that Western visitors should go to, and they described My Lai, and they described something I had not been aware of, even though I thought I was aware of most of the heinous activities that went on. But not only were over 400 people, civilians, children, women, and elderly men mostly killed mercilessly, but a number of women were raped. Not only were they gang raped, but then they were summarily executed by the use of M16s put into their sexual organs. Now, this is horrific, and I'm sorry to have to speak about this, but we didn't know, most of us didn't know that during the protest period, but the main or a significant substantial number of the victims of U.S. military aggression over there were women. And it wasn't put forth as a feminist issue, but in retrospect, it should be seen as, in part, that kind of issue, because war turns women into objects more than anything else. And that ISIS kidnapping and sexual abuse and assault and rape of Kurd women and then selling them into slavery takes us rocketing backwards into medieval times or something totally barbaric. What can be done about that? Do we then change our position on drone warfare? Well, I'm prepared to say maybe. Follow me? Because even though I'm adamantly opposed to what we've been doing with it in Afghanistan and Pakistan, suddenly there's this new nine-headed demon on the scene. So you just have to keep studying and talking among each, with your friends.
I just wanted to give you a reading assignment since we are in a college classroom. A classic book, as relevant today as it ever was, is by Susan Brown Miller, and it's called Against Our Will. And it's a story about women rape and history. And from her perspective, and it's a very provocative view, everything that has happened to women has occurred because we are physically too weak to protect ourselves without selling ourselves, and I mean that theoretically, to a male protector. So marriage is the result of this dynamic, rape, women as spoils of war. I think if those of you who were around in the 70s can remember, the first time I read Susan Brown Miller was like the first time I read Kate Millett, which was like the first time I read Simone de Beauvoir. These are the three books that absolutely made you rethink everything you had ever thought about humans and human society and women and men. So I'm sure you can buy it on Amazon.
You want to know the names? So it was Kate Millett, Sexual Politics, and there was Simone de Beauvoir, The Second Sex, I assume you're talking about. Yeah. The Second Sex.
And Susan Brown Miller,
Against Our Will.
Against Our Will.
Although there is enormous criticism for the racism in Susan Brown Miller's book, so there's lots of other stuff to read. Her stuff on race in that book is horrific, so just to be aware, these are not perfect by any means.
One over here. Sorry.
This one here and one over there.
You can go
first, yeah.
Yeah, I would just like to introduce myself. I'm a old friend of Sheila's, although I don't know if she recognizes me, but my name is Myra Kaveri. I'm the moderator, facilitator of the International Network of Women with Disabilities. And I would put out forward to you that disability rights is the next revolution. And it's been coming. You know, the ADA came in 1990. The United Nations Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities was the text was adopted in 2006, and also Ictus Harpist. I played in the General Assembly Hall in 2008 at the celebration of the entry into force of the UN Convention. And it is, and when in December 2006, when the text was adopted, I was standing at the elevator, and a sexual colleague of mine, standing next to Kate Millett and another colleague of mine, saying, "The revolution has begun." So, welcome. Please join us. We're 20% of the population, according to WHO. I think that figure is way low. War disables people, rape disables people, trauma disables people, everything, all the work that you've all been doing for the half generation prior to me. You get it. You know, you have all the intellectual background I'd like to add to your list. Leslie Feinberg's Transgender, book on transgender, and No Pity, about the disability rights movement. And if anyone wants to talk to me afterwards, I'm here. Thank you.
Well, that was probably me. And I just wanted to actually put in a plug for a class I put together. May I do this again?
Yeah.
I'm Eileen DeBald. I'm a professor in the ILR school. And I have stories I can tell you about what ILR told me about the women. When it was mostly male, and they all say they were terrified of the women in their classes because the women were so much smarter. So yeah, they talk about it all the time. So anyway, I put together a class for all of you students who are here if you want to think more about some of these issues, where we have a different person come in every week and talk about how their research around gender affects the workplace in particular. And it's called the Gendered Workplace. It's ILR and FGSS 3820. And I really encourage you all of your student types, I'm sorry, a whole bunch of student types just left, but you should sign up for it if you haven't already. It's a 2-credit pass-fail course, so it's not heavy duty, but it's really interesting, and you get to meet all sorts of interesting people doing really interesting work. So I just wanted to.
It's taught in the spring or next fall. It's taught in the spring. So it's taught next semester, Wednesday afternoon. So do we have like two more questions and then we'll go up or comments? Yes. Well, we've heard a lot about all the stuff that still needs to be done. It's clearly an ongoing issue, but I wonder what you think about the successes of this. I see a lot of ways in which the feminist movement, which is a feminist movement,
Also has really been successful. How about you? What do you see as the successes? Well, I'm politically oriented, so the very presence of women in the high office, the very fact that individual males are beaten at the polls when they make ridiculous statements about God deciding who's been legitimately impregnated and who's been raped. I mean, there we have made progress. We forget because it's two steps forward, one step back. But just the numbers of women and their aspirations. I'm not on a campus, but I live across the street from a campus. And I assure you that women are not taking things the way they did. In our circles, the issue of sexual harassment and sexual abuse of girls, college-age girls, has been met with a very powerful bystander education movement. And a lot of us adults who aren't necessarily runners, are being trained or asking to be trained to play a productive role as bystanders if we see any abuse taking place. Normally females, I weigh 120 pounds, so I can't really take on a male who is abusing some female sheerly, you know, physically, but there are means by which we can render ourselves more potent. And that, you know, that's just the latest. And I invite you all to learn to be bystanders. I just wanted to make one last point. For me, awakening, if we can use the term, began with Kate Millett. And she may seem dated to some of you, but let me just tell you, if I had a chalkboard, I would draw it for you. What she said that changed my life and everybody who ever heard her in those years or read her, she said there are three dimensions along which we, speaking of American women, let's say narrowly, are differentiated by our society. The first is temperament. And it's presumed, we're told we are born with different temperaments, one gender to be more dependent, the other to be more independent, one to be more pugilative, the other to be more passive and fearful. Temperament, we are told by society, leads inevitably to roles that are appropriate to our temperaments. So the roles that are assigned to us are not entirely arbitrary from their point of view. They fit the gender that is more dependent and a more feely groupy, and other roles are assigned to the gender that is defined by our society as more rigorous and more analytic. And that's why women find themselves in nursing and in teaching young children, not teaching, you know, older people, and in the softer fields, and men find themselves in engineering and technology and out there in the world. And then thirdly, the third dimension on which we are differentiated, it's a simple structure, is status. The status meaning where do you stand in society as regards power or potency. And here again, temperament, being more dependent, more feely, leads to roles which are not in the mainstream of where power resides. And inevitably, not that anybody planned it this way, women are less powerful. And then she stopped for effect and said, let's imagine that structure turned on its head. Maybe we aren't born differently temperamented, but rather, there's a group of patriarchs, and she really used the word patriarchy in a very new way back in 1970. Maybe the patriarchs get together and decide that in order to stay in power, they will have to assign the other gender the roles that keep them very much out of power. Roles like taking care of small children, or taking care of sick people, or taking care of disabled people, that will keep them out of power. And then, lest they resist this assignment, as some of us do, we have to persuade them that they are temperamentally suited only for those roles that are disempowered. And anyone in the 40s, if any of you remember that literature about the tyranny of the orgasm, anybody who said something like, I really am not as demure as you are defining me, or I would really like to get some power into my life, would be defined as, remember? Penis envy. Well, it wasn't the penises we envied, it was the power we envied, and when she said it, we were home free.
Hey. That was great. Too.
Do you
want to
ask the last question?
Back there. What? Oh, she's back. Oh, she taught her course.
Yay, welcome back.
All right. Wait, so you're going to stay overnight and all? Yeah, well, we better find you a place to stay. Let's just come on back. Oh, okay.
Tell them to buy her.
I had sent in the tickets to see. I didn't keep a copy.
Yes, there's a last question there. Let's just finish that.
Why don't you ask Irene a question? Yes, if anybody has a question for Irene.
And you guys should all buy everybody's books. last question, comment.
Sorry. I've heard a couple sentiments tonight. This might be like a byproduct of a talk on the glory days of the 60s, but with sentiments like other countries that are catapulting us backwards, or like the revolutionist elsewhere, I was wondering if the panel considers modern Western feminism to be a more outdated venture than other social aspects.
No, I think it's global. We aren't our mothers. I mean, I actually wouldn't be quoting Millett here. I actually think that we are so informed by the transnational and global feminisms. That's how we think about it. That the language we use, what we teach our students, is our capstone course is called Global Feminisms. I don't think there is a thing anymore called Western feminism. I think it's too global. And so, no, to answer your question, no.
So maybe on that note, can we just thank everybody?